You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today is Michelle Lamont, who is a professor of sociology and of African and African-American studies, and the Robert L. Goldman Professor of European Studies at Harvard University. She's got a fantastic new book. It's called Seeing Others, How Recognition Works, and How It Can Heal a Divided World. I know you'll enjoy this pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over
time, the expectation. Michelle Lamont, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, it's going to be a slightly long first question, but I'm somewhat obsessed with framing. And this is a book that is very much about narrative, and I think framing as well. And so you write in the introduction of your new book, quote, "In particular, I'm interested in how groups gain recognition from one another, how they come to be seen as valuable, and what that recognition does for their quality of life," end quote. So you're a sociologist, not a psychologist, and not an economist. And that's pertinent to this topic because you also write, quote, "Psychologists tend to focus on what is happening inside the minds of individuals, while economists focus on material circumstances and the distribution of resources," end quote. So I guess my first question is, what's different in this topic from a sociological perspective?
Well, instead of focusing on the intracranial, I look at how we can organize societies differently so that we populate our environment with narratives and institutions that can really broaden inclusion and give cultural membership to people. So it's more about, you know, how can we create seeds of change that have to do with how our society is organized and what messages are given to people, instead of the nudging industry, if you will, that really focuses on, you know, stimulus response that happens at the intracranial level. So it's a very big difference, I think.
Yeah. And so I think what I'm hearing is that what you're saying is that it's not just an individual and the choices they make. It's not just a system and what that system is. There's other things at play. Those things can be at play, but yes. But to really tackle this, you have to take all of it, which of course is harder.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I focus specifically on the parts of the environment that other disciplines have not looked at. You know, narratives, tons of people have studied this, but I think that really to look at it systematically in terms of how it, you know, the narrative environment contributes to broadening inclusion is something original. And also, I talk a lot about the law and policymakers and how every policies, whether it's the creation of food stamp or same-sex marriage, are sending messages about who's in and who's out. And I think we can really read every decisions that are made by policymakers in the Supreme Court in terms of who's in and who's out. So it's also a contribution of the book.
I want to talk a bunch about narratives, but one of the areas I want to talk about first is this idea of recognition. And in particular, and this might be a stretch, but let me kind of go for it. My wife, who's a tenured professor of comedy, has a comedy theory, and her three elements of comedy is all comedy has pain, element of pain, element of distance, and an element of recognition. She used to call that truth. She stopped calling it truth when she realized it didn't have to be true. It just had to be recognizable. So this is in the context of comedy. And you write in the book, quote, "I propose that we shift perspectives to make sense of the role that recognition plays in our lives. When I say recognition, I'm not talking about mere identification, as when you recognize someone on the street. Rather, I mean seeing others and acknowledging people's existence and positive worth, actively making them visible and valued, reducing their marginalization, and integrating them into a group," end quote. So this is, when you're talking about recognition, you are talking about big R recognition, I guess I'd call
exactly,
it.
Exactly. I think in the book I say also, it's not like I recognize this is an apple, you know, it's not.
Which, in comedy, sometimes that is what's funny is like, oh, my dad behaves like that.
Exactly.
But you're moving beyond that. I guess the seeing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the term recognition is complicated because, you know, if you say defining someone as worthy, people understand what this means. But the word recognition itself is not as commonsensical. No. You have to explain it, which is why the British edition of the book doesn't have the word recognition in the title.
Oh, what does it have?
It says redefining worth instead.
Interesting.
Yeah, the exact title is How to Redefine Worth in a Divided World. So they really made a very different, and the description of the book is somewhat different as well. So,
I imagine that's a good thing with regard to recognizing where you are. Different words mean different things, and the importance is getting across this idea. And this is the whole point, right? It's not so much the way what you say as the way of what you say, the way someone else takes it.
Exactly.
Oh, that's fascinating. All right. So your experience, I want to talk a bit about your othered experience, because in many ways, as you point out, you could be considered the least othered person in terms of where you work. You're a white person. You work at Harvard. You know, could not be, you know, in some senses more in, but you do have where you grew up. So talk a bit about your background.
Yeah, well, the introduction of the book, I explained that I'm French Canadian and I grew up during the peak of the nationalist movement in Quebec, where the country was very much defining itself against American imperialism and against English Canadian imperialism. So, and now here I am. I've lived in the US since 83. I obviously have an accent. I raise kids who are American, but at the same time, I'm a leftist. So I'm not fully identified with an institution such as Harvard, which is very much perceived as extremely elitist and pseudo-meritocratic, but I teach, you know, I studied in France with a sociologist who really was a leading expert on denouncing meritocracy, you know, saying a lot of this election, is now becoming common sense in the US about, you know, meritocracy is not a thing because upper middle class people have so much advantages at the starting point. Well, the person, one of the key people who was promoting this theory is the person with whom I studied in France. So strangely enough, you know, I'm not at all what I seem to be, I think, on paper. Mm-hmm. And also when I was a student in France, I did my graduate work there. I had friends who had been victims of the dictatorship in Brazil. And I had other friends who had survived the Khmer Rouge, you know, so experiences that really marked me in terms of my intellectual vocation and why I wanted to become a social scientist. So.
And I guess the other thing about this is your past, but also your present. So I know when you started the book, which was during the Trump administration, correct?
Yeah.
Which makes perfect sense. But this pendulum, right, is in such an odd place right now. And I mean, even we're taping this today. They've just set the court date, you know, for Trump. And then, you know, everything just, you could list a series of events that have happened last week that stand in stark contrast to us ever thinking that we could live in a place where what you're talking about this book, like could happen. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And the book, when I started it, was premised on the notion that the, you know, the arc of justice that Obama and Martin Luther King were writing about would be rectified and would continue in the direction of greater justice. And, you know, many people like the economist Albert Hirschman wrote about reaction, counter-reaction. Every social movement is creating, you know, the pendulum. So At the same time, I think things have improved, you know, in so many ways in terms of, you know, women's access to the labor market. We can also, I think, read a lot of the changes in a very positive way. You know, LGBTQ rights, you know, the claims for pronouns and unisex bathrooms are also very much a sign of how much queer people are now claiming membership, and at the same time, in many contexts, getting them, you know, getting greater membership. So I'm more on the hope side, in part because I wrote a book on hope. So,
So there's some sort of staggering numbers in the first chapter. You cite a Pew Foundation that from 1983 to 2016, the share of aggregate wealth going to upper income families increased from 60% to 79%. While lower-income families had only 4% of aggregate wealth, which was down from 7% in 1983. The other thing that you mentioned, which is, goes to the narrative idea, was a study that was done about American sitcoms totaling 68 years of television that found that 80% of the show's characters were upper middle class, while just 10% were working class. Of course, that means that even less were poor people. Mm-hmm. So I think the point... How can you make equal, let's just say that, something which you're unwilling to see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I'm so glad you're pointing to that piece of evidence, because this is something that many people don't know. Mm-hmm. And it means that working class people never see positive representations of them on the mainstream media. And all they see is glorification of rich people or glorification of professionals. And this really gets, I think, I connect this directly with the opioid epidemic or, you know, death by despair. All we know about the ways in which the working class has had a lot of problems thriving, you know, over, it's not been a story of, you know, thriving. It's been a story of steady decline for the last 50 years. So the first two books of first two chapters of the books are really downers, because it explains not only the growing inequality, the figures you mentioned, but also the way in which a society that is so deeply organized around the celebration of professionals, college educated professionals and managers, is constantly sending to others the notion that they are outside, and that, you know, even if they don't have a college degree, no matter what they do, it's really, really difficult to feel worthy. So impressing the challenge that the vast majority of the population are facing. And I also mentioned the growing spatial isolation of the upper middle class. So it's easy, if you constantly live in an upper middle class environment, to totally ignore the extent to which your life is different from the life of the vast majority, because, you know, the figures are clear, the extent to which, you know, marriage, schools, neighborhoods have become segregated on the basis of class over the last four decades. It's extremely impressive, the extent to which it's happened, and many Americans have no clue. So,
yeah. During COVID, my son, my grown son and I decided, we went on this quest, and this is well before the sitcom The Bear aired, which was, we're looking for the greatest Italian beef in Chicago. So we would like search on the internet, and then we go to these neighborhoods. And I realized, maybe, you know, halfway through this journey, I'm like, what is it I'm experiencing? I'm like, oh, I am completely out of my bubble. I'm going to these, you know, places where there are lots of Trump voters, for example, which, yes, I don't live near in where I'm in Chicago. And every weekend we're going someplace different, and it really changes you. Yes. And the other thing that I thought was so interesting, you talk about this in the book, is how we as a culture have attached a moral or ethical failure to those people who are poor.
Yeah.
And I, like, is this like from the Puritans on, or where does this come from? Because when you objectively stand away from it, it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I think, central to this is, of course, the American dream, the idea that, yeah, anyone in this country has the opportunities to succeed. And that vision makes abstraction of what resources people have from birth, which are extremely unequal. And then also the notion of self-reliance, where I wrote a book titled The Dignity of Working Man, which is a very in-depth look into the life of working people in Paris and New York. The interviews were done in the early 90s. And I show really the centrality of self-reliance. You know, the workers I interviewed who lived in central New Jersey, in the New York suburbs in general, were really going on and on about the sponges and how much they hate the sponges because their own identity is about working hard and paying their bills mm-hmm. and making sure that their kids stay out of trouble. So there's just, they would define themselves as survivors. So the enormous amount of efforts that they put into surviving means that they have really great deal of disgust with people who don't have the moral strength to do this. So the sad story of this book is that they very quickly slide from making these moral boundaries, you know, mm-hmm. rejecting people because they're lazy or don't have moral character, to also drawing boundaries toward the poor. And then often it slips from, I hate these people on welfare, to, I hate these people, these Black people on welfare. So you can really see how their self-concept as hardworking people, it anchors the racism that some of them express, you know.
It's interesting, chapter three, you talk about the concept of grit and even self-care as failing to address the root mm-hmm. problem. And I mean, a lot of people talk about grit in my world, and I understand it, of course, to a certain extent. But I think what you're saying is that there's a narrative that can easily be corrupted.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, the concept of grit, as Angela Duckworth formulated it, is very much, you know, an internal capacity to meet challenges. You know, it also kind of downplays the environmental determinants. So instead, I promote this notion of social resilience, which is really how do you create a society that gives people the tools they need to be able to encounter, to deal with the challenges that come their way. So that's very different. You know, the idea we can engineer our society differently.
I thought it also interesting, you talk about moral tribalism, and you say, quote, we know boundaries are changeable because we make them. They're created mm-hmm. through a process that we all participate in. I really want to talk about this because the moral tribe argument, like the left loves to talk about this, and I get why, right? I understand, I'm, you know, part of that group, I get why. But you bring up a really interesting point in terms of, it basically isn't our vision being limited by just thinking in that we're kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the people like Jonathan Haidt who are pushing tribalism, they kind of presume an eternal human nature. And my point of departure is we have a lot of discourse on human nature. But people who write on human nature, I think, are like archaeologists, you know, they have tiny bits of evidence from which they draw a very large conclusion. So if we make abstraction of the discourse on human nature, we're left with nothing. We don't know what human nature is, and it's highly changeable. There are many periods in history where people were very generous toward those who were unlike them and vice versa. So in another book, I really pushed the notion of groupness to understand what makes that some moments in history people are really sticking with their groups and unable to understand the other. This is highly variable. And it has to do with physical contact. You know, psychologists are pushing contact theory. There's a lot of evidence that it's true. The more contact, the more people are able to understand each other. But it has to do also with spatial separation. So societies like Brazil or Japan, you don't have the same degree of spatial separation across classes that we have in the U.S. In the U.S., the fact that schools are funded by local taxes pushes an enormously high level of class separation. And many people don't know that either, you know.
Yeah. Or if you live in a city like I live in, they built a highway to separate the Black and brown people from the white people.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, it's interesting too, you talk about Jonathan Haidt, and certainly that's who I was thinking about with this work. And I recall a conversation I had with Nick Epley at the University of Chicago. And he really doesn't love the term around microexpressions. Or microaggressions, in part because he's like, it's so, for you, I could be not liking you for so many different reasons. For you to nail it down to this one is a giant leap. And I never thought about it that way, but it's like, no, these things are terribly complex. And when we get so reductive, we're actually maybe ending up doing ourselves a disservice than a service with regard to the much larger goal that's going on here.
Exactly. And, you know, micro aggression, like, let's say, you know, pushing someone when you get into a bus, those are, you know, very, very micro act. But there's some things that are way more important, like, for instance, being overlooked or underestimated or ignored, you know, that I think a lot of that literature, the people who study those aspects of racism totally miss. In our book, Getting Respect, where we did over 400 interviews with Black people in the US, Brazil, and Israel, we found that the main thing that people talk about, members of, you know, racialized group, when they talk about their experience with racism, they talk about what we call assault on the self, being underestimated. People think, oh, he's not going to be able to do this, or simply being invisible. Like, people don't ask your opinion ever. And this really adds to what epidemiologists talk about as the wear and tear, you know, of racism. Like, it gets under the skin and it has huge impact on your health and on your subjective well-being. So, you know, definitely. I think microaggression is an easy expression, but it doesn't account for the complexity of what people experience.
I'd love, there's some phrases and words that get tossed around a lot these days. And I'd love just to get your POV on them. And you do talk about them in the book. First one is the term woke.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Have at it. Tell us about woke.
Yeah. Well, I discussed the term in the book by putting it in historical context. And in its first use, like this singer, Badu, talked about it in terms of being aware of what's happening, you know, being vigilant to the forms of repression that Black people were, you know, victim of. So being tuned in, if you will. And then, of course, at this point in history, it's being appropriated as a way to denounce the snowflake, the so-called snowflake demands for pronouns and toilets, you know, and it's used very much to dismiss or to portray as illegitimate the needs of people who really feel excluded, like trans people. There's a reason why they want unisex bathroom, because they don't identify as binary, you know, and the sexual binary means nothing to them, and they want people around them to recognize it. And I think it's very easy to simply ignore their needs as something flaky or something overly sensitive, you know, and to dismiss the whole Gen Z generation for, you know, being talking about traumas that in fact are not traumas. But can we tell Black people that being ignored or invisible is not a trauma? It's just being flaky to ask for attention. Well, it's easy to say that when you're in a position of, you know, power, just as, you know, women have suffered also from being silent in the background serving tea. You know, they could have been denounced equally for asking too much. So it's not unusual that populations that have been marginalized are perceived as asking too much. So time will tell. You know, at the same time, we know, since we have the 2024 presidential election looming, that more needs to be done in terms of getting on board, especially working class people who may be extremely impatient with woke culture. And how do we create a bridge between them and the progressives who are, you know, supportive, who are opposing Trump? I think that's one of the big stakes that are looming that we need to figure out really, really quickly. So
when you talk about that in the book, I immediately thought of an exercise we created at the Second Science Project, which you and I were talking about before we started. And it came in response. I'm going to ask you for a yes and question in a little bit to end the podcast, because this yes and concept in improvisation is very well known. It was the thing that we taught to the scientists, our very first exercise we taught them, because they wanted to see what that looked like. And the idea is very simple, right? I mean, what we know from behavioral economics tells us that people's default position is to say no or do nothing. And yeah, it's easier to lay on the couch. I think we all get that. And so the idea of yes and essentially forces you to not just be positive about something, but additive to that, relentlessly additive. And it gets you to very interesting places comedically, but we find that as well just in life in general. So the scientists asked us, they're like, well, what do you do when you don't want to yes and the person across from you? You fundamentally disagree with them. And we didn't know, and they didn't know. And so we kind of went away to our sort of improv playhouse, and they went away and looked at different literature. And we have a paper coming out next year about this. The idea that we settled on, we've been conducting this with thousands of people, is an exercise called Thank You Because. So we have two people share even a minor disagreement, like chunky peanut butter or smooth peanut butter. And we have them try to convince each other of it. And that gets you to the normal places of nothing. And then we ask the participants to use Thank You Because. So thank the person for the information they shared and find something, no matter how small, that you agree with in what they say. Mm-hmm. And what we've discovered is over time, they stay in the conversation longer. They find points of agreement. They're more interested in what's going on. The reason the paper's taking so long is we decided to also study just one side doing the Thank You Because.
Still works. Oh, okay. That's really interesting, because my intuition as you describe this is to think, well, it's about recognition. If you talk, you have to acknowledge that the other has another perspective.
You have to keep talking. You have to keep talking.
And also
the intent behind the talking. Like, so I think it's very hard to say thank you.
Yeah.
And not sort of mean it for the other person. And then that second part, which is kind of the yes and to it, right, is that I'm going to take this one little step further and find something. So what the way when I have to teach this, what I have to say is, when my daughter got sick, one of her best friend's parents were anti-vax. And this is well before that became fashionable. But, you know, we didn't want to have conflict. And so my thank you because with them is, I said, thank you because you care for your girl so much, you don't want her hurt by vaccines. I care for my girl so much, I don't want her hurt by someone who's not vaccinated. The important things we care about are girls.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was, we were good. Like, the kids FaceTimed, they did other stuff. It was all, like, it didn't, yeah, they couldn't be in the same room together, but it didn't create this bigger sort of, like, issue. It didn't have to become a moral judgment of, like, I think you're wrong. And I do.
Yeah.
but it didn't even come about that. And it's like, oh, that's a whole different thing that I don't think people know is available to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the idea that we can coexist even if we disagree, or we agree to disagree because we acknowledge.
As if we haven't been doing that forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, so clearly, we have been living in disagreement with other human beings forever, since there were humans. So what is it about now that suddenly we can't do it?
Yes, that's a problem. I think it's always been a case, you know, that societies are both ridden by conflict, but also require collaboration. And we've always had. And if you think of what a long-term relationship is about, a marriage too, you know, I mean, you constantly negotiate, and sometimes you dig in your heels, and sometimes you decide to really be generous. And I think, you know, I mean, I could mention the names of the sociological authors who have really developed one or the other face of the coin, but I think it's truly the yin and yang of social relationship. You know, we need each other, so there's a lot of compromise and coordination, and the division of labor requires coordination, like the great classic, the book titled The Division of Labor by Emile Durkheim. What I'm saying now is, like, for each part of these ideas, there are canonical books in the history of my discipline that are exactly about that. And you've had, you know, the power structure theory and the conflict theory opposing the functionalist theory, which was all about social integration. So my take on this is both are required for collective life, and we have no choice about this, you know. But now you have also an enormous amount of discourse on polarization and on false news and on, you know, which is coming at such a rapid pace. If we were to eliminate all the discourse and the analysis on it, it would be experienced very, very differently. If you remember when the essential workers team emerged during the pandemic, there was, and the banging on the pans, there were at the same time enormous feelings of collaboration, and we're in it together, and we just have to, you know, work through this together. So, and many people experience great moments of togetherness also during that period. So,
yes, that's happening at the same time Asian people are being targeted on the street. So your point, these both things, and I guess there's no joy without suffering. There's no suffering without joy. This is not a frame that we don't understand or shouldn't understand.
Yeah.
We talked a bit about recognition, and you go a step deeper when you talk about recognition chains. So yes. I found this fascinating. Tell us about recognition.
Well, the idea is that I give the example of Black photographers like Hank Willis Thomas, who created a piece of art in the public gardens here in Boston Commons of Martin Luther King embracing his wife. And it was extremely controversial because seen from a certain perspective, they were headless. One of the arms looked like a penis. So it created a huge debate about public art. Well, this is a very important person because he created a YouTube video that was massively diffused through the collaboration with a philanthropic organization, the Black Man Achievement Campaign, I think is the name. It's escaping me right now. I can tell mm-hmm. you a little bit later. But the idea is that in order to scale up messages, artists such as him really need the support, the financial support of philanthropies. So through the book, I gave several examples of how creators, stand-up comics, you know, TV, think of Black Panthers, you know. Yeah. I interviewed the VP for global programming at Netflix as I was doing the book. And Black Panther was a massive phenomenon in Africa, in India, you know, I mean, putting Black people on the streaming services globally, this is quite something else in terms of capacity to intervene. We're talking scaling up at the global level. So it's really about, I mentioned division of labor earlier, so collaboration, people who share a common project and who are all pushing in a direction, in the same direction of, you know, trying to create a society that is more inclusive. So that's basically what the concept is trying to capture. And it's tied to network analysis, you know.
You talked to my friend Ai-Jen Poo at the National, who's the National Domestic Workers Alliance. We did a program with her group at Caring Cross Generations around improvisation and caregiving, and it was multifold. Once we used our exercises to sort of work with caregiving communities, but then we also created content and narratives and stories and ideas, because the reality that she sort of exposed to us and became very clear once it was in our heads was this is another group of people we don't see.
Yeah,
and we had a really brilliant economist on who wrote he's got this whole book about food as it relates to economic principle. And when he talks about the caregiving communities, like, well, we just don't don't pay them.
Yes.
So many of them are just not paid. And if you're not paid, you're not part of like the GMP, like you don't exist.
Exactly.
And which is insane, given what is more important than that.
And children. Yeah.
Yeah. Scott Galloway talks about all the time about this country just seems to talk a lot about caring for children and then all their actions go the other way.
Yeah. Yeah. And her work was so important in part because it's tied to the film Roma, which incidentally was made possible by the Ford Foundation because they have an organization called Just Film that really subsidized the creation of that film. So that's a really, really good example of recognition. And my colleague, also part of the recognition, my former colleague, Matt Desmond, his book, Poverty by America, is also very much about the fact that the professionals and managers don't pay the guy who mows the lawn and don't pay the babysitter. There's always this idea of trying to skim on how much money you're going to give to all the help that allows you to keep up with your busy life and to raise your children, et cetera. And that's very, I think, not viewed as really creating poverty in America, but that's exactly what Matt's book is about and why it's powerful, I think, because it makes everyone, you know, reexamine how big tippers are they? You know, do you tip your waiters in a way that allows them to make a decent living, you know?
So you have some faith in Gen Z coming up.
Yes.
I do. Tell us why you.
Well, the reason is because the American dream is not working for them anymore that it worked for the millennials. And I think, as we all know, the pandemic was really hard on them. Many of them have had mental health issues. And their solution is to create the world they want to live in right now and not when they are 60. You know, they don't want to jump on the hedonistic treadmill of consumption and saying, I'm going to get a bigger house and a bigger car and a bigger bigger Peloton bike and that will make me happy later. Instead, they believe that living together in a more inclusive society, in a more caring society, a less hierarchical society, is how we're going to get happier. I'm not saying they all do this, but we interviewed for the big book 80 Gen Zs, and they all really stress that they want a society that is more caring. And they have this T-shirt that says "Be a kind human." So there are major themes in the way they approach their life, and one of them is the idea of social inclusion. And they are very involved in politics too, so they're pushing it a lot of. The current revival of the workers' unionization push is tied to the involvement of Gen Zs. So and they're also rejecting a life that's totally organized around work and the ideal worker of the person who's going to work 60 hours a week for what, you know. So they also embrace the work-life balance, which is, I think, a very good thing as well. So they're extremely critical of my generation, the boomers, because they thought we were, you know, hopeless workaholics who were really, many of us, they thought were in great need of psychological intervention. If you have any Gen Zs, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I think as boomers, we have two choices. Either we think of them as losers who will never amount to anything, or we try to understand what their perspective, where does it come from, and how their life conditions lead them to make the choices that they're making. And I think, frankly, we have something to learn from them.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you talk about this in the book, too. The boomers were also critical to the civil rights movement.
Absolutely, and that's where the Gen Zs are full of it, because they totally underplay, you know. In the introduction of the book, I explain one of the reasons that made me passionate about inequality is I had to empty the dishwasher every day while my brother mowed the lawn once a month, you know, and I felt it was deeply unfair. So these forms of everyday feminism in my generation, it was absolutely crucial. We broke a lot of, a lot of barriers, and they totally underestimate. And the sexual revolution, too, you know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
My generation, I mean, it was really pre-AIDS, you know.
Yeah.
There were lots of, we lived our sexuality very differently than my parents' generation did. So they don't understand that. They're very ignorant of the past, those Gen Zs. So
it's interesting. I'm sitting here that I had a conversation with my 25-year-old who is in 2 weeks moving to Atlanta for 8 months to work at a Shakespeare theater. He quit his corporate job because he really wants to be an actor. And I remember him saying to me, I have no illusions I will ever own a house.
Yeah.
Which was number one, very like, oh, like I, that didn't, it didn't dawn on me that that wasn't going to be available to me.
Yeah.
I'm 50, I just turned 57. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is because he's moving to Georgia, he's like, oh, this is great. I'll vote down here. So immediately he was also thinking, playing the odds of what I need to do to help what's going on in the world and where he doesn't want to have happen in the world right now. Right. And so it's just such an odd, what an incredible thing, both in terms of when I relate to how my parents talked about their life, where I am and where he is. It's
And he decided to not postpone his decision until, you know, and I have a son who, currently wants to be a firefighter. And the reason he wants to be a firefighter is because he wants to help people. And he thinks it's a great way to have a meaningful life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's an interesting, I have to do a lot of self-examination when I think about my reaction to his decision, you know. And he also wants to move to New Hampshire to be able to vote.
A firefighter in New Hampshire, sure. Right. Yeah, I mean, I recall, like, I'm the youngest of six boys, and when I told my dad I wanted to work in theater, he was thrilled, and it was because everyone else was like an architect or a banker or whatever, but he had always wanted to be, and I didn't want to be an actor, but he wanted to be an actor and he wanted to live in that world, and he was, and I just like the gift I was given, and I think this is a gift. It is just thinking anything's possible.
Exactly. Like, but the conditions were so different, you know,
the conditions were different. And the privilege I came from, like it just being a cisgendered white man, you know, is a world of difference. That it was open to me. There were zero closed doors.
Yeah, and you know, I left for Paris to do my graduate work in 1978, and I was 20 years old. And my mother was really freaking out about me leaving for Paris at this age. But at the same time, the job market was such, and I studied political theory. You imagine that's not a growing field, right? Yep. And it's very much similar to your story, except that when I came back to Canada in 83, there was the job market in academia was not very good. So I went to Stanford, and that's how I ended up American, because I met my partner there. But all this to see, we're of a generation where things were possible, whereas our kids are very aware that things are difficult, but at the same time, they don't want to just necessarily become cogs in the system, right?
No.
We want to have a meaningful life. The alternative is to be hopeless, and many of them are hopeless. Many of them have major mental health problems. So I think that's become so acute that it forces them to really contemplate the alternatives. So
yeah. Okay. We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. So a time in your life, could be work, could be life, where, and this feels like a layup for you, where you didn't just say yes, you said yes and. You affirmed and contributed in a way that maybe surprised you. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Yes, but it's still unfolding. As soon as you mentioned you were going to do this, I thought of accepting to do a trade book because my agent, who's had been following my work for several years, really thought I would be good at doing this, you know, and she felt, okay, I had been president of the American Sociological Association. I'd written books that were well received by my peers, but she said, you have things to say that you want to tell everyone and just go for it. And I was very hesitant, but then I said, sure, I'll do it. And now that the book will be published very soon, you know, and I do write-up ads, and of course they get turned down. It's hard. It's very, very hard. So, but I kind of hang to the idea that with conversations like the one I'm having with you now, it can make a difference, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of have to hang on to the hope that these exchange really make the whole suffering worth it.
Well, and I think to
this
our earlier point,
a very sincere answer to you.
It is. No, and I think to our earlier point is you probably couldn't have had one without the other. You couldn't write the trade, you know, book, which is for a popular press for people to know that, without having done the sort of academic work that maybe stayed in that world, and vice versa in some regards. And so, you know, so everyone's journey has to, you know, and that's what this book is. And it's like, I just said this to my friend Claudia the other day, I said this morning, which is like, if we could all just have like a beat of grace with each other.
Yeah.
Like all the interactions during the day, like if everyone just did that with each other, like we could change a lot, because it does feel to me that so much is I'm going to assume bad intent, and I am going to then, you know, throw that out there. And what I'm saying too is, even if someone does that with you, if you could take a beat of grace, it's probably going to come back. It's going to get better, as opposed to getting worse. Maybe not always, but enough that would change things.
Oh, absolutely. Driving in Boston would be very different.
Driving in Boston would. I have driven in Boston. You are 1,000% correct. Oh, my God.
Where people are going F you all the time.
Oh, the war, it's the worst.
The level of aggressivity is off the roof, you know? So,
At least your book is not trying to solve driving in Boston, because I think that actually is impossible. The book is called Seeing Others, How Recognition Works and How It Can Heal a Divided World. Michelle Lamont, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking me. It's a treat, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.